I'm delighted now to welcome Stephanie Argy and Alec Baim. They are co-writers and directors of the film The Red Machine, which is screening at the Santa Fe Film Festival, along with their short Gandhi at the Bat. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So this is a terrific movie, The Red Machine. It's a heist movie set in 1935 with sort of the snappy, quick-talking characters and a very, very amiable and likable safecracker.
Oh, thank you so much. That's Donald Tom Scopello, who is actually going to be with us here in Santa Fe at both of our screenings, along with his parents. But he is terrific. We met him when we did Gandhi at the Bat. He's also in that one as the A's first baseman, Jimmy Fox. And he was very obliging about letting us hit him in the head with a baseball. And we recast him again in Red Machine.
He's a great actor. And it's an interesting story. I mean, he's a safecracker who never gets caught. Somehow he gets caught. And he's recruited by the Navy to steal a machine. And as we will hear in this clip, steal it without really stealing it.
Exactly.
Is this based on any kind of actual code machine that you researched or that you knew about?
Yeah, we did a lot of research on this one. There really was a Red Machine. It was Japan's first machine for encoding secret messages. And there were other machines that followed on it. And everybody knows how those codes and those machines were cracked by the military.
Other Japanese machines.
Other Japanese machines and German. Everybody had their own code machines. It was a great race. But the Red Machine, how it was actually cracked and how the U.S. Navy decoded the codes is shrouded in mystery. Nobody really knows, but there are rumors of break-ins and other events, and we ran with that. What a great story.
So it's not really a true story, but there's some truth woven in.
Right, and it's a conjecture of what might have happened, but of course a love story has to be woven in.
Well, yeah.
Very much so, yeah. And that Eddie, the thief, is called Eddie, and his minder for this mission is a very stiff, cold Navy spy. And over the course of the movie, we discover that he's actually the subject of our love story. He broke a heart and had his own heart broken in Japan years before, and our re-encounters.
And there's little flashbacks to that.
Right.
And what's great about it is it's very well crafted, the film. So
Thank
the flashbacks
you.
Are very recognizable because of the color and the sensation of them. And the strangeness of that character, of that Navy spy. How did you develop that character? He's so cold. He's almost robot-like.
Well, he's broken. I mean, he was on a mission in Tokyo 7 years earlier. And even though the mission went well, things, you know, with his girlfriend at the time didn't go well.
He felt as though he had really, really hurt and betrayed some people. And the character made the decision to shut himself down. And our thought with the character was that he's essentially has killed himself in a certain way without the formality of actually dying. And that's how we find him. And that's why we wanted to have that extreme performance. And Lee Perkins, who plays him, was very brave about going to that extent, because that's not easy to ask an actor to do.
Yeah, it's surprisingly difficult to do so little. I mean, because it's not like it's not like you're doing so little, but to appear to do so little. And it was, it was really interesting to do it. And, you know, he would keep wondering, well, you know, should I do some of this? And you keep kind of saying, well, no, let's see less.
Mm-hmm. And especially when there's a heartbroken lover inside.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And then, but when you put it all together, it becomes this extraordinary thing. And it is a strange performance, or it is a strange characterization. I would agree with you on there. But I think it's extraordinary.
Did you look to movies of, say, the 30s and 40s for style?
Very much. We've always really liked that era of movie making. So things like, for the dialogue, His Girl Friday or Bringing Up Baby were big influences on us. The Maltese Falcon was a big one. We also looked at some of the 1970s movies that were set in the 1930s. So things like The Sting or Hard Times, and those were an influence as far as the aesthetic as well. And then the third element of the mix, we also looked at some of the old French capers of the 1950s and early 60s, which were very bold in their use of silence. And that was an interesting example as well.
When you look at movies that are made in one period, which is now long gone, and set in another period even further gone, they sort of betray their aesthetic, like The Sting betrays a 70s aesthetic, mm-hmm. even though it's set far earlier.
Yeah, you can totally tell yes. when it was made.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It's funny.
And I think when you do this, you have to know, even though it's hard to see your own time, that you're doing that as well.
Very much, yeah. There are certain aspects of it, I think, the choice of the technology that we used to make it, how it was put together, just the language that we all speak right now, the filmic language, is a particular dialect that in 10 or 20 years will be totally different.
But we also didn't want to just make something. We sort of consciously set out not to make it look like, well, let's make it look like a 30s movie.
Yeah.
Because we could have tried to do, oh, let's make it black and white, or let's choose a filming style that's very slavish to that, and we thought, no, that's not appropriate.
That's actually what we did with Gandhi at the Bat. The short that plays with this is a mock newsreel. And for that one, we researched and did about 17 hours worth of tests before we shot to make that one exactly like a 1930s newsreel.
And we were very strict on that one. Here's how it has to be. It's a very, a newsreel, a very narrow path that it takes.
Yeah, we can use these lenses. We can move the camera like this. We can, very, very particular. And we did consider it for Red Machine, but we wanted it to have its own style that was a gesture to the period, but its own modern interpretation.
Yeah, and then it's fun, and you can use color in a creative way, and so on.
Right. Which we did as well. I don't know if it was noticeable when you watched it.
You did mention it a bit about the colorful flashbacks.
Yeah, which you did. Well, for the flashbacks, we completely obliterated the color red from the modern part of the movie. We said red is only in the past.
Right.
Until the very last scene of the movie, when our two characters are reunited, she's wearing a red sash.
Ah.
But also, we wanted the world of the thief and the world of the spy to be very different. So everything in the thief world is shades of brown, and everything in the spy world is blue or gray or black. So that's very, very cold and mechanical, whereas the spy's or the thief's world is very organic and full of life, as he is.
And because, the two characters, the thief goes into the spy world and it's totally foreign to him. And the spy goes into the thief's world a little bit and it's totally foreign to him. So they both stand out like sore thumbs, and that was on purpose.
And they don't get along very well at first, either.
They don't get along very well at first.
No, not at all. No, it's a classic buddy movie dynamic there.
Right.
But they're forced to work together and say, okay, what are we going to do?
Now, when you work with color like that, it's funny because I suppose other filmmakers and film aficionados notice that, but for everybody else, it just goes in unconsciously, but it still has the effect.
Mm-hmm.
That's
I
the
hope.
So. Yeah, that's what you do with so much of what you do with filmmaking. You don't want it to be overt, but you want it to enter in on that subconscious level.
Yeah, you really don't want people to notice what you've done. You just want to feel it, I think.
Right, and to be seamless.
Yeah.
Now, you Alec, are a musician, and you also did the music for both films.
Yeah, kind of inadvertently. We were looking for a composer, and we met with several, and weren't quite finding what we wanted. And when we were putting the film together, we didn't use any temporary score. Because normally when you edit a film, you put in temp music to kind of suggest what you want the music to sound like. And we were afraid if we did that, we'd fall in love with something that sounded like that and then find a composer and say, okay, make it sound like that. And that's really not very fair.
Yeah. Right.
So we always, we'd talk to composers and not have anything in, and they were, I think, getting a little frustrated with, not having any reference. So we talked to one guy, and he said, well, can you put in, actually, you know the story better than I do.
He asked, just lay in some sketches, lay in something that would show me what it would be like.
Some sketches, yeah.
Some sketches, or even just any kind of music. So I said to Alec, well, why don't you just put in a few things that you've done? And he did, and suddenly we heard it and said, oh, that's the music that we've been looking for all along.
So I hadn't planned to do the music, but I'm really not a film composer. But it sort of fit. And then I took it seriously. I sat down, I'm going to do this music for this scene. So I do this music for this scene. I give it to Stephanie, and she said, oh, this would be good in this scene. It was never the same scene I had done the music for.
Oh, isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. So you make a film like this. The two of you do everything. How do you, it's the classic question of independent filmmakers. How do you manage it? How do you do it?
Creatively or financially?
Both. Well, financially.
Financially, we also work for other people in varying capacities. Alec is also a cinematographer on these projects, and I do editing, visual effects, and write as well. So we scrape together the entire budget. We had saved up money and got to this point.
And for post-production, we owned all the gear
to that
already, which we had that for a while and learned how to use it.
Yeah. When it came time to make this movie, we had a certain amount of money saved up, and we said, well, we could do a big down payment on a house, or we could make a movie. And given what happened to the real estate market, we're glad we made a movie.
Yeah, really. We're talking to Alec Baim and Stephanie Argy about the film The Red Machine. Tell us a little bit about the short Gandhi at the Bat.
Gandhi at the Bat is a mock newsreel about the little-known incident when Mahatma Gandhi pinch-hit for the New York Yankees.
Little-known because you made it up.
Well, exactly. Well, we didn't actually make it up. It's based on a short story that originally appeared in The New Yorker in 1983 by a writer named Chet Williamson.
A marvelous story.
Yeah, it's just a great little story. And we found it, and Chet was kind enough to let us adapt this. And it was thrilling. It's been... Red Machine is just starting on its film festival life. We debuted at Mill Valley, and then this is our second festival ever with Red Machine. Gandhi at the Bat came before that, so it's played all over the world. It's played in Germany, it's played in India, England, France, Italy, everywhere. It's been the most amazing learning experience to have this little movie travel and touch people in so many ways. And that was what really introduced us to Santa Fe, because Karen Redhawk Dallet got a copy of Gandhi at the Bat, and she contacted us about that one. And we said, well, we have a feature, too. And she booked them both together, which is the first for us.
Oh,
yeah,
we're
opening for ourselves.
Yeah.
Which I'm curious to see how that goes.
Yeah.
Now, are you looking for a theatrical release, or what do you hope the life of the Red Machine might be?
We're exploring. Right now, there are so many different options in terms of independent film distribution. So we are looking for theatrical exhibition, but in a smaller way. We're not really looking for... We wouldn't rule it out, but we're not looking as hard for a traditional distribution deal. We're very interested in exploring what they're now calling hybrid distribution, where you split apart your rights, and one company might handle a limited theatrical release, one will handle DVD sales, one will do foreign things. And that's what we're looking into right now. So it gets a little more complex, but...
And it seems like it's changing, which is, you know, I think it's pretty exciting to be... In the cusp of that, to have a movie at this point when things are changing, it's like, okay, well, let's see. And since we paid for it ourselves, we don't really have to do anything except explore.
We can be very bold and very experimental.
Right.
So they're not people, you know, screaming for their investment back.
Exactly.
So we can be pretty experimental. So I think it might be a rare opportunity that we get, so we might as well explore it as far as we can. So we're going to experiment.
It's an interesting moment in film right now. And we were talking about this with Karen and with John Bowman, the executive director of the film festival, that filmmakers can now afford cameras and editing equipment and everything else and make their own films. And you own your own cameras, mm-hmm. and your own editing equipment.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the sound as well, and the post sound. And
right. And so what would have been impossible 20 or more years ago is now in your apartment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's thrilling to have the freedom to do that. I think, I don't know if you read the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. Uh-huh. It's a really cool book, and he talks about how achieving mastery at something, to become really, really skilled at something, is a matter of time. Spending, say, 10,000 hours 10, doing a particular thing. That's the number.
That's the magic number, yeah.
It is. And in the past...
And we should have kept better track.
We should have. But... You think back to the old studio days, and filmmakers and actors and everyone were able to get so much more experience. There were so many movies being done. And now we're almost coming back to that again, where you can work so much, you can do so much on your own. And as a filmmaker, you can learn and practice and grow.
Because it's like anything else, you need to practice. You need to spend time doing it.
Right.
And if you're waiting for the studio to say yes or no, you're just waiting.
And it's interesting because, in my position interviewing so many filmmakers, I've seen some wonderful films like The Other Bank was one of my favorites of this festival, and then some that really were just not that good. And I was talking to the man who made The Other Bank after our interview, and I said, what do you do when you have these people who've made a movie that just isn't very good? And he says, tell them never give up. So people who are making these movies that, their first try is... somewhere between dismal and mediocre, they might still end up making a terrific movie 5 or 10 years from now.
Think about your first try at almost anything. It's probably not going to be very good. Your first pancake or your first attempt at playing a song on a guitar.
But the stakes are so much higher in a movie.
It's true. Well, that's it goes back to what you said as well about the new technologies, that it does make the entry a little bit easier and make more room for that kind of experimentation and practice.
Well, Stephanie Argee and Alex Baim are co-writers and directors of the film The Red Machine and also the film Gandhi at the Bat, which are both, they're playing together, and they are on Friday at 7:30 at the New Mexico History Museum and then Saturday at 6:45 at the DeVargas Cinema. And it's great to have you here for the Santa Fe Film Festival.
Thank you. We are thrilled to be here.
Thanks.
Can't wait to go
us.
Explore Santa Fe.
Excellent. And here's a little clip from the film, The Red Machine.
See, people generally let you know where to keep the most valuable thing in their house. The door that's closed when the rest are open, an extra neat table underneath a painting. You might as well just put up a sign that says, hey, burglar, look here. For instance, in Shimada's apartment, you look down that hall and every one of those locks are standard issue, except one. That's a schlag. Schlag is a fancy, expensive lock, kind of generally see on the outside of a building, very secure. So first off, you figure, why have a lock like that on the inside of the apartment? I just see only one. Another thing, the floor in front of that door is full of scuff marks. Just a lot of foot traffic going in and out of there. Only question is, how do we get it out of there?
We gotta figure out how big it is, how much it weighs, is it fragile?
You think we're supposed to take it out?
In my experience, that's the best way to steal something.
Not this time.
No.
They suspect anyone anywhere has even seen the machine, they'll instantly stop using it and switch over to a completely different system.
And we don't want that.
No. We want to go right on using this one for as long as possible.
So we gotta steal this thing without really stealing it?